Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. My apologies, we have come on a little bit late. We've been trying to reach Bob Curran. He's in Ireland, and at this time, we have not been able to get through to him. So what I'm going to do is move ahead. We have left messages and this type of thing. So sometimes phone systems overseas do not always work in a cooperative manner. But again, Bob Curran, we were going to be talking about vampires in America. By the way, Bob is such an amazing man, and I want to mention this because he's been on my show before. And being from Ireland, you know, there's always this phenomenal mythology and the incredible history of the Irish people. And it is, to me, utterly magical. And, of course, I have a soft spot in my heart for leprechauns and all kinds of fairy people that are, well, they're just so special among the Irish. And they are such a phenomenal people. And I have such a deep regard, too, for the Irish women. They're known not only for their wit, their intelligence, but also for being some of the most independent women in the world, and
your
their history is complete with the dynamics of their personality. And he has been a man that's gone around the world. He has just been a phenomenal historian. So we are still working, trying to reach him today. And I had gotten an email from him. I got his phone number from him.
Your guest is online.
Wonderful. Bob, you're with us.
I am indeed, Donna. How are you?
Oh, I'm so delighted. I was so concerned, and I'm so delighted that you're able to join us today. It is just a real privilege to have you. I have been promoting the fact that you are a historian, and you have done so much research into so many different arenas. For those of you, for those of my audience, Bob, that have never had the privilege of seeing some of your material, what in the world ever prompted you to become a researcher as you have? What was it that stirred the desire to be this wonderful individual? And I say wonderful because not many people are going to be curious enough about history, but you have this innate curiosity. Was there a special teacher in your life that just made you say, I want to explore this?
Well, Donna, if you knew a bit about me, you would know that I grew up, most of my books, I should say, to start off with, are mainly in cultural history and traditions and how the supernatural has affected, has been affected by various cultures and has affected our interpretations of the world. But I grew up in a very remote area of Northern Ireland, on the edge of the mountains. And here, culture and history played a great part, particularly notions of the supernatural and notions of folklore and notions of sort of tradition being handed down within that community. And I suppose that's where it all started off, and it affected me because I was growing up in the culture of the time. So I asked myself whenever I got a bit bigger and older, why are people interpreting the world in such a way? And I suppose that's why I got into this research. Now, if you if you could see me, Donna, and you could see the gray in my beard, you will realize that that wasn't yesterday. So I've been traveling about, and I saw that people in various parts of the world used exactly the same techniques, the supernatural, the unexplained, things like that, in order to interpret the world just as it had in the county down where I was brought up. So I suppose that was the reason. I grew up among it, I became part of it, and I used it to interpret the world around me. And then I said, why? And I began to explore that. So I hope that answers your question, Donna.
Well, it does, and I'm so glad you shared that, because I often feel that there's these triggers that occur to us when we're younger that allow us to open up into these modalities of choice. And you're a wonderful writer, and you have done so much research regarding vampires, American vampires, and I just chuckled at this, because when I was growing up, the most exciting thing that usually was talked about were like maybe somebody reading tea leaves or witches. That was the big thing, or gypsies. Mm-hmm. So I never had really much of an exposure. Maybe it was just my family environment. I just don't think they were into it. Yet I know with the Catholic history of religion, which was part of my life, there's all of these little weavings that go into it. But for some reason, as I became a teenager and then grew into adulthood, I always thought it had to do with Transylvania. I mean, I really never, you know, I knew about who was, you know, Boris Karloff with his portrayals, and there was the other fellow that was really known for playing Dracula. And
Christopher Lee.
Yes, yes. So I was certainly aware of it, and it's funny to me now as an adult woman to see your research and go, holy Moses, vampires were considered to be part of cultural mythology for tens of thousands of years. It's all over the world.
Absolutely, Donna. Can I ask you personally, did you never really sneak off to the cinema and watch some of these? Because whenever I was young, I was brought up in a very strict environment. And
mm-hmm.
Whenever I was, I suppose, in my teens, I never saw television until I was about 16. But there were films in some of them. And later on, I went off to see people like Christopher Lee and Ingrid Pitt and things like that. But you're talking about culture, because vampires are part of the culture. Remember that I was talking about the cultural interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things which we tend to think of, as you have already said, Donna, we think of vampires as either gaunt, Eastern European, Transylvanian people wrapped in dark cloaks and stuff like that. That's Christopher
right.
Lee. Or angst-ridden teenagers at some remote rural American school, which is Twilight or Buffy the Vampire Slayer, or
right.
the things my daughter is into. So, vampires actually come out of the cultural history of a people. And where else could you get such a sort of rich stew of various cultures coming together and living cheek by jowl than in America? Because America is a fabulous country. It has all sorts of strands of culture. It has Italian, it has Spanish, it has French, it has British, and it has its own Native American culture. So all of those have begun to develop. When the settlers came to America, they brought their own nightmares with them.
Mm-hmm.
And these fused with the nightmares that were already there among the Native American peoples and began to, as Shakespeare says, form something rich and strange. And so I began to look at vampires right across America and how the culture of the area in which they were found had influenced them.
Well, I want to say that your book, in the beginning, goes through various cultures throughout the world, which I thought was just absolutely wonderful, because, as you've just said, we are a potpourri of just about every culture on the planet.
Yep.
And so people bring, as you said it so well, their nightmares, their fears, their hopes, their talents, the good, the bad, the ugly, all of it comes with them wherever they go.
Yep.
Now, there are areas in the country, obviously, that were affected first. And what I want to do is talk about New York, because New York is one of the most incredible places on the planet, I think. It has such an amount of history. Tell us what you found about New York. I mean, vampires can be anywhere, but
Well, Donna, over here, we tend to think of New York as being very sort of modern, up-to-date, things like that. But you're quite right. Beneath the surface of New York is an older city. Remember that New York was colonized, first of all, by the Dutch. A gentleman called Adrian Block arrived there in the 1600s and began to colonize around about. And the American, name for the area was the New Netherlands, and your city was called New Amsterdam. And you can still find traces of this in places like Hoboken and the Bowery, which comes from an old word for pear orchard or farm. You can see it in Brooklyn. And Wall Street was the big wall, which the last governor of the New Netherlands, Peter Stuyvesant, built to keep the British out. The British came in and they captured it and named it after James, Duke of York. So it became New York. But underneath, the old Dutch influence is still there. Now, among the Dutch and the German peoples, there was a tradition which was known as the Nachtmarie. These were night visitors. These were things that came in the dark whenever you were asleep. Now, they were not necessarily vampires as we understand them, but they were creatures which could draw the energy from you as you slept. And in a house in New York, there was a patch of mold which grew in the form of a human shape, which was supposed to draw the good from the people who lived in the house. That was almost by a process of osmosis. Now, it's really strange you should ask me about this, Donna, because about two or three days ago, in fact, just about last week, I received an email from the NYPD from a guy who worked in it. And if he's listening to it, I'll say hello to Mike Guazzo. And he says that he knew about the place and he could take me almost to the very street that the house had stood on. So, and he says I'm to give him a ring because we had talked about stuff in New Orleans. I emailed him back and we had talked about stuff in New Orleans and all, which of which he also knew. So, yes, there was a patch of mold, a bit like a human form, and it was thought that the house itself had been built on an old Dutch graveyard. And that there was something there. Now, whether or not it was a vampire in the conventional sense, or whether or not it was something which had, there was illness in the house, there was tiredness and torpor all through the house. It may have been something to do with the damp or whatever it was in the house. But people did not feel happy there. People felt chilly there. People felt cold there. And so there were problems within the house, and few people continued to live there. But it is odd because it's even today, and I'm getting people from NYPD saying that they know the place.
Fascinating. Let's shift to another part of the United States. Now, one of the things I want to make a comment about is that I really appreciated how you bring out in your books, any one of your books, the various components of culture that existed in particular areas at certain times, just like what you talked about with the Dutch with New York. Because I think sometimes we need to know the history of a place, and that's not always easy to find out. And this you did also with the Arizona-New Mexico part of the country. And with New Mexico and Arizona, you go into the Native Americans, and you talk about how they have, in the American Southwest, a term called skinwalkers. Now, this information is so different from most of the conceptualizations that we have from things that have been promoted in Hollywood. Yet, with your research, it's so interesting to find out about where the Native beliefs or how they have still maintained the Native American beliefs, still maintain certain positions. I know the Iroquois that were near New York, they have certain understandings to this day that they talk about, even though a lot of their elders are gone. Tell us how you evolved into the Arizona-New Mexico positioning of understanding, and who are the skinwalkers? How did this come about?
Well, Donna, vampires in the American Southwest are slightly different to the vampires which you would see on your Hollywood screen, because they're not exactly human in form. But also in the American Southwest, vampirism is closely associated with witchcraft. So Native American skinwalker or vampire doesn't really and necessarily have to be dead. These are creatures which can take off their skins. Now, the actual vampire itself is not human in form, but may be a small ball of light, and which can travel at great speeds across the open spaces. Now, when it travels at such speeds, it travels to a house or a teepee or whatever and lingers outside it and begins to draw off the good which is in the house or the tent. It can draw from people, it can draw from food, it can draw from almost inanimate objects if it wishes. Then it shoots back and gets into the skin of the skinwalker. The skinwalker is simply the outer husk of the vampire. It's like the Indians described it as almost like a bit of corn, in which you take off the husk and there's something inside. Now, that is where the skinwalker, and there's places in New Mexico and Arizona, there's an area in the Southwest which is known as the Skinwalker Ranch, in which all sorts of strange lights and stuff have been seen about that, and I refer to that in the book. But the skinwalker, or the vampire, is closely associated with witchcraft, and it's evil people who do this, or people who have become evil through various rituals. People may wish to make themselves evil and have power over people around them, and there are people who are known as skinwalkers, people who are known as witches, and who can do this sort of thing. Now, the other thing which is strange is that in South Carolina, among the slave peoples, the Gulla, who have come over from Angola, we have a sort of similar thing. Although it's not a ball of light, it's a monstrous thing, which the person takes off their skin and it becomes awful. The only way to sort of disable a vampire there, if you like, is to find their skin and put salt inside it. Then it won't come. Among certain of the Native American peoples, it's exactly the same with the skinwalker. Put salt or hot chilies inside and they'll not be able to get back into the skin and the sun will destroy them. So you have sometimes similar beliefs among Native peoples, such as the Gullah who came from Africa or the Native Americans in the Southwest who have settled there. So all through that, you have the notion of evil lurking within people, like corn within the husk.
You go into areas of the country, California, Wyoming intrigued me because part of what you give in the way of information is history among the Native Americans. And in part of this, there was the little vampire men. It was the folklore of the Cherokee and the Chickasaw. And they're older than, quote-unquote, the red men, which I thought, this is just confirming that there were people here in these United States of America tens of thousands of years ago. So there's all of these stories that evolved, and I think, wow, this, you have uncovered a lot of information here. But the little vampire men, they were also was Wyoming. Wyoming. I think of buffalo and big hills and open plains and cowboys on horses and vampires in Wyoming.
Well, you're not the only one to find Wyoming fascinating. In fact, I have literally just come back from Wyoming. I was in Wyoming about 2 or 3 months ago, and it is a fascinating place. But and I pick Wyoming because they found certain artifacts in caves and mummified bodies in caves. But the idea of the little vampiric man, if you like, is wider, I think, than Wyoming, and older than we actually know. Now, for example, whenever Coronado came up from New Galicia in Mexico, looking for the seven cities of gold in the central United States, he came across as far as Kansas. During that time, his cattle and the provisions that he had brought with him for his army were attacked by little gray men from time to time who drank the blood from his cattle. And that is attested. And the Indians who were with him, for example, the Zuni, and the other tribes said that these were little men who were older than they themselves were, that they had existed for a long, long period of time. And in Wyoming, in places like the Medicine Bow Mountains, you have the big medicine wheel up there, in which I refer to. But you can almost feel, if you're up in the mountains or round about there, all right, you have the buffalo on the plains and the cowboys and horseback, as you quite rightly say. But up in the mountains, whenever you're alone and things, you can almost feel that people are watching you. And there's caves up there. And where do the caves go? And maybe there are little men, because they have found mummified remains up in some of these mountains. So you're looking around, and perhaps little men are watching you. Little men who are much older than almost the countryside around you. So be very careful whenever you're up in Wyoming. It's not all cowboys and buffaloes and stagecoaches.
Ah, yes. Well, Bob, this has just been wonderful. And I want to mention you also, you've come out with so many books, and another book we don't have time to chat about it today, but A Haunted Mind, about an author, H.P. Lovecraft. I wanted to mention that because this was an American writer who had tremendous impact on what you call the modern horror scene, Howard Phillips Lovecraft, and he started so much of what now is considered the world of the horror movie and the horror books and other things, and he was a fascinating man. So you've got two publications here that are absolutely amazing. Now, I have to ask you a personal question, Bob.
Yes?
I need to ask you something. When you do this research, has this ever at any point scared literally the pants off of you where you just go, I can't do this anymore? I mean, has it ever overwhelmingly intimidated you where you couldn't go to sleep?
Donna, I sleep incredibly soundly.
Okay.
In fact, I'm much more worried about the crime figures around this area than I am. There are things that I can't explain, and I just say to myself, you know, Bob, I can't explain that. It's part of my interpretation of the world. There are creepy things. I have to admit that actually have sent a shiver up my spine.
You're going to have to share one of those stories with us right now. What's the creepiest thing you've ever experienced?
One of the strangest things I've ever experienced was whenever I was doing research for a book called The World's Creepiest Places, I traveled out to an island, which is not a million miles from here. It's off the coast of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And I was alone there. Now, a lot of the local boatmen won't. Who come from the island of Lewis will not stay there. There's only the ruins of an old monastery and a lighthouse on the island. Now, in the lighthouse, three keepers disappeared at the start of the 1900s. Nobody knows what has happened to them. The island is bleak, it's empty, and the wind whistles through gullies in the rock. Now, the boatman dropped me there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and he said, I'll come back for you at 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's okay. And from 9 to 5, I was the only person on that island. And it is said that the island is the gateway to another world. And people have vanished, including the three lighthouse keepers there at the in 1900. And I will tell you this, Donna. It was a combination of the loneliness, the combination of the tradition of the island, which the locals call, or the people on Lewis call, the other world, and the sound of the wind whistling in the gullies and the gulls crying overhead, and the sense that you are the last person alive in the world, and you are the only person in that part of the world. Now, that is a scary thing.
Well, Bob, I can totally relate to that, and I'm sure my listeners can, too. Your material is wonderful, and vampires are so hot at this time. I don't know how long it'll continue to be that way. It seems like we go through waves of fascination with certain subject matter. But the movie world has really grabbed onto this. Television series have grabbed on to the concept of vampires, and the younger generation is just enthralled with it. Of course, I'm amazed at how good most of them look. But anyhow, there's just this absolute fascination, and again, what is so mesmerizing about your publication is the research and history that you pull out about peoples that go before. And of course, I feel that everything has always left a memory bank in some way, shape, or form around whatever has been. And I think there's a lot of people listening that would say the same thing if they've done the research. And the Native American culture relates to this. And I just think your book, American Vampires, is great. And if you're into the horror scene, you're going to want to know about his other book, A Haunted Mind, by H.P. Lovecraft, who really, as an American, brought on something that to this day is a huge, huge market. One of my friends, Bill Nolan, is a contributor to that. He has become recognized in the world of quote-unquote horror, the story of same. Bob Coran, I know you've got a busy schedule. You're out the door just as soon as we finish this interview. Thank you so much. I'm so delighted that we've been able to chat today.
It was lovely talking to you, Donna, and we'll do it again sometime.
I look forward to it, Bob. You just fascinate me with all of your wonderful historical stuff and the tremendous magic of storytelling that you have. Bob Coran has been my guest. Check out his blog spot, Dr. Dr. Bob Coran, and that's curran.blogspot.com, and you'll be able to keep up with his latest fascinating discoveries. Bob Coran, thank you again for being my guest today.
Thank you very much, Donna.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. You too, sir. Bye-bye.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. I know it's a bit of a unique topic talking about vampires, but one of the things that Bob does that I, again, and I said this a couple of times during the interview, he does a lot of research on history. And when you go into things of the past, I think one of the most fascinating things you can ever do is talk to people about culture and where belief systems start from. And it takes a bit of digging to be able to realize how people have taken the world around them as they perceived it and understood it and manipulated it sometimes to, what do I want to say, account for whatever might be going on in their experience. And we've got an interview that's going to be coming up next month with a woman from the Middle Eastern culture, and she will be sharing a lot of the things that happen there that I think it's wonderful. And when we can understand that, then many times we can understand where our fears come from and how in the universal consciousness of everything we can become either empowered or paralyzed by what we know. And fear, I've always said, is a two-edged sword. It can either motivate you to move forward and out of ignorance and superstition, or it can paralyze you, keeping you a prisoner, where it will dominate your space because you're not really capable of knowing or being aware of other things that are outside of you. The life we live holds a lot of mysteries to it, and I don't think those are ever going to be anywhere, anyway. Anytime soon, maybe in a billion years or so, they might be eradicated, but it's going to take a while. But it's fascinating. and it allows you to get a picture inside yourself sometimes. Where do your fears come from? Why is it you have them? Donna Sebo here. We've got a call-in number. If you would like to call in and chat with me, my telephone number here is toll-free, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And tomorrow we're going to be talking about the business of wanting more with Brian Gast. Now, Brian, when I saw the book, and I mentioned this yesterday, I thought, oh, my goodness, this is going to be more about acquiring more stuff than how to visualize this, that, or the other. But that's not it. He's talking about how to live your life with a sense of richness. This is a man who has made millions, multiple millions, lost it, gone back and made it again. But he learned some things, and that's why he wrote this book, The Business of Wanting More. He's going to be coming from a paradigm of life, experience, and attainment of wisdom. So I hope that you will join me tomorrow. And also, I wanted to let you know, for those of you who are listening in California, I'm going to be in Southern California, February the 4th through February the 9th. And I am going to be available in Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, Glendale, Burbank area. And I'm going to be available for private appointments. I'm going to be doing a show with Pam Ostley in California, and that information will be coming out in my newsletter. And I hope that if you would like to meet with me while I'm there, whether it's by phone or in person, just give me a call at my office and we can set up some time. That's 253-582-5604. Telephone number to call into if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. So many times when we are in the fortunate positioning, and I really mean it's fortunate, of having, as women, the right and privilege of freedom and of choice, we are unaware, number one, that it took quite a battle in this country before we were able to have those rights. When we hear of women, little girls, being put into situations in other countries that should not be done because we feel that that is not proper, treatment of women is just appalling. And I raise my hand when I share my statements about this, about many different cultures that I'm aware of. As a counselor, I've encountered many, and I know and I empathize with a lot of the suffering and the fears and the concerns that women have from different cultures in the world. But I came across a story that really left me with a lot of emotion. And a part of me got very angry, and a part of me on the other side understood the wisdom of this child's experience. Her name is Najud, and she is from Yemeni, and I hope one day to be able to interview her. I'm not sure that that's going to be possible anytime soon, but I really would like to have that opportunity. But there is a book that has come out that is about her and her life, and her story evolves around how at the age of 10, her father betroths her to a man that is substantially older than she is. Her mother had 16 children, and that's sort of hard for us to comprehend. But you have to remember the culture wasn't unlike that in the United States. Here in the United States, many times women died in childbirth because they had one baby right after the other. Women over a course of 20 years might have 10, 15, even 20 children. There are records around the world of women that have had massive amounts of births. They didn't have any birth control. Well, that is partially what happened in her culture. And at 10 years of age, she had just begun school, been in school a little bit, loved school, absolutely loved school. Her dad tells her she's going to be married. Now, she said she didn't understand it. Life at home was very difficult. Her father had not been able to find work, and her father was often imbibing what's called CAT, K-H-A-T, just because he needed to cope with everyday life. So he would do that. He had an addiction there. Her brothers were trying to make money. They were like little beggars out on the street. And they were all taught they had to do something to bring in an income. And she was just about at the time when she was going to have to go out and do work on the street. Well, the father was concerned for her. And it's very common in her culture to marry girls off. In fact, there is a tribal proverb that says, to guarantee a happy marriage, marry a 9-year-old girl. And this man had walked up to her father one day, just walked up to him and said, I want to marry your daughter. And the mother said, my daughter's too young to be married. This is just not possible. But in her culture and in her country, even though her mother did not want this to happen, she said, the men give the orders. The women are merely property. This is who they are. Well, wedding preparations go on. This is what's happening with her. She has no control over anything. And she's told that when she enters into this new family, she has to leave school. She loved school. School was her refuge. She could get away from home, get away from all of her siblings, and she was learning things. She just absolutely loved school. Well, her new mother-in-law was extremely old. She said she had skin as wrinkled as a lizard. Their living conditions were absolutely terrible. Well, contrary to what was said to the father, the man that married her violated her. She had no choice. She lost consciousness during the violation. She said after this occurred to her, she had no right to leave the house, no right to complain, no right to say no to anything. She had to totally obey her mother-in-law's orders. If she didn't, her mother-in-law would pull her hair. And then, a few days, the third day, after she had been brought into the home, the beating began. And this was supported by the mother-in-law. She absolutely was totally, at 10 years of age, in no control of anything. The day came when she was able to visit her family. Her father said to her, you are a married woman now. You must stay with your husband. You cannot divorce him. If you divorce your husband, my brothers and cousins will kill me. Honor comes first. Well, in a culture that she was born into, husbands are allowed to have multiple wives. She went to see the second wife of her father. Now, this woman did not live with her mother and 16 kids, but she was a very good woman. She was a very nice woman. She had her own place, but it was very, very poor. And she said, my father had totally neglected her. She had to beg in the street to be able to survive. And she told her second mother, if you will, what had happened. And this is what she said. She said, if no one will listen to you, you must go straight to court. And this young woman, Nuhud, was surprised. She said, to court? She said, yes. Well, she had seen a courtroom on a show she happened to watch at a neighbor's home on their television. She said, you go to the courthouse, her second mother said. Her name was Dawla. You ask to see the judge. His job is to help victims. Now, what she did, she ended up giving Nuhud some money, and she said, I want you to go and buy some bread for breakfast. She said, okay. No, her mother gave her the money. Excuse me. She went back to her mom, and her mother gave her the money. So she takes the money. She said, okay. She goes, and she, instead of going to the bakery, she changed direction. She didn't know where the courthouse was, but she stopped the taxi driver and she said, I want to go to the courthouse. The taxi driver took her to the courthouse. She meets a judge, Abdul. Here she is, a young girl, 10 years old, standing in front of the judge. She says, I want a divorce. He looks at her and he said, you're married? She said, yes, I am. He said, how can you be married at 10 years of age? She didn't bother to answer the question. She said, I want a divorce. He wanted to know why she wanted the divorce. She said, because my husband beats me. He then asked her a question. Are you still a virgin? She said, no, I am not. I bled. Now think of this. A 10-year-old girl. When she told him that, he said, I'm going to help you. He talked to some other people in the legal area. They didn't think that this was going to happen, wasn't going to do any good for the girl. He got advice, this is a case you cannot win. In Yemen, girls are frequently married off quite young before the legal age of marriage at 15. Well, in the United States, in the South, in many areas of the country, that's where it was. In fact, girls could get married at 12 or 13 in the United States, depending on what part of the country you were in. But no one before in the court's history as a child, had ever walked into a courthouse to say, I want a divorce. Because of fear, intimidation, they'd be murdered. They have no value in the society. So that's the status. It's an amazing story. She said she knew at that young age that if she were forced to go back home, if her husband would come to get her, she'd be tortured, even killed. She'd disappear. So she kept insisting she wanted a divorce. One of the judges said, we can't let her go home because she won't survive. Now, according to the law of Yemen, he said, because of who you are, your age, it's difficult for you to file a complaint against your husband and your father. There's no birth certificate for this girl, and she was too young to initiate proceedings against anyone. A contract had been signed and approved by the men of her family, and in Yemen tradition, all of that was valid. So what they did, they arrested the father and the husband so that she would be protected. He said it's better to put them in prison than have them free. Oh, boy, that's a biggie. Even at 10 years of age, she realized how significant that was. Well, you know what? She got a woman attorney, and I realize that I'm running out of time here. This story is so powerful. And she ends up getting a divorce. She's now attending school. People congratulate her because she has achieved something that was never done. Now, in April of 2009, the Yemeni parliament raised the legal age of consent to 17 years of age. The next day, it was overturned. Today, men still can take brides of any age. The reason I wanted to share this story, and I know that it's just a very, very brief summary, it's important to understand that one thing that makes a difference is education. And any time you take away the right of education from young men and women, children, when you take that right away, and you stay in situations that depress communities, this kind of event can happen. But she's lucky. She's still alive. And she's going on with her education. But for this young woman, this today, which she is a young woman today, but at 10 years of age, she had a spunk and a courage that enabled her to break tradition and to become an individual in her own way. And her story, if you're interested in knowing about it, she said, I'm Nujood, that's N-U-J-O-O-D, age 10, and divorced. That is the title of her book. This is Donna Sebo, and I know that we're out of time here. Tomorrow we're going to have a wonderful interview with Brian Gast, and it's always a pleasure to be able to share information with you, because I think through the gift of technology, media, we can open our eyes to a lot of things that many of us choose to ignore. Ignorance, fear, and superstition are three of the greatest enemies of any of us. And it's only through education, being able to read, to be able to write, to be able to communicate, that we are going to be able to make this world a better place. Ignorance only is going to be able to be overcome by education, opening our minds up to new worlds, to new understandings, and to be aware, not to necessarily bash anybody else because they don't know what we know, but to understand that we can lift them up through understanding. We have to be able to show people that there is a better way. And when you hear about human trafficking, when you hear about slavery, yes, it's still going on in parts of the world, it is something we need to realize that's an ugly essence that rears its head. And sometimes we really have to be alert and aware so that we don't allow it to gain any more power than it should. We need to be able to understand that by being aware ourselves and being willing to open our minds, our hearts, our attitudes, being willing to change and be flexible, we can leave this world a much richer place. So never think that you don't make a difference. This judge and his associates in Yemen made the difference in the life of one young girl, 10 years of age. Her story now has gone into print, and millions are going to be able to read it. It makes a difference. Her world is going to influence other girls' worlds because of what she had the courage to do. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with me today. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.